Welcome to the Atom Ventures podcast. My name is Bhairav Patel. I'm the CTO and founder of Atom Ventures. And I'm here today with Sanjay Rakshit from Albert AI. So say hello, Sanjay.
Hello. How are you all doing?
So I'm very excited to be speaking to you because not only are you a very knowledgeable man, but this is a topic that is obviously of massive importance at the moment. And I think it's something that everyone will want to know a little bit about. So today we're going to be talking about artificial intelligence, delving into the worlds of machine learning and natural language processing. And Sanjay here is an expert in this field. So Sanjay, do you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, where you started, how you started?
Yes, kind of one trick pony, really, building software products all my life. Started way back in 1996 as a software engineer, and then moved on, stayed in engineering for years, product engineering, product management, headed up, launched a few products. A few worked, a few didn't. But the good thing is that I think the you know, being with HCL, BayWZ, NCR, they gave me the complete view of how products are conceived in terms of from concept to market, the life cycle of a product that includes, and then the importance of technology and the business side of a product. Like that is what perhaps my background is taking product, taking an idea, using technology, building a product out of it, and flogging it.
So how did you get into AI, machine learning, informatics, such?
It's always been something that I've been interested in. Even my background, I did statistics in my undergrad and computer science to lay a foundation for AI. AI is extremely mathematical statistics based. So at the time in 1992, the world was going through what was called an AI winter. Therefore, master's courses in artificial intelligence, branches of AI, were not really out and about at the time. They were not widespread. So I had to go and get a job. Software engineer, got a job. But over the past about 6-7 years, 8 years, I've been building products which uses, based on customer intelligence or subscriber intelligence. So we were doing pattern recognition, recommendation based on collaborative filtering. And, you know, little knowledge is dangerous, right? So I built the products, they weren't very good, now that I know. And I soon realized that I had to get a formal education. And that's my background.
So what is your formal education so far?
So a couple of years ago, I did a postgrad in AI, which is a generic topic specializing in machine learning and robotics. And there I gained a fascination for speech and language processing, which is pretty much the driver behind conversational AI. And now, so I went back to uni after working for a year, setting up a AI function in Martin Currie, I decided to pursue a specialization in speech and language processing. So at the moment, I'm in the middle of completing, hopefully, fingers crossed, my postgrad in speech and language processing from Edinburgh.
So a 2-for-1 academic here. That's what we have today in front of us. So that's great. So, okay, let's start with the obvious question. And what is AI, and does AI equal machine learning?
So it's been used synonymously, but they're different. AI is pretty much the ability of a machine to think and then take a decision. So an ability of a machine to think like a human, human-like intelligence. Yeah. And so that's AI in a very short, in a nutshell. Machine learning is a subset of artificial intelligence. Imagine that is the tool that is used in order for machines to learn.
Right.
So to gain the ability to be intelligent and hence make some decisions, you require machine learning. So machine learning is a methodology that is used to learn, to gain intelligence.
Okay, so I remember you gave me a tap analogy once when we were speaking down the pub. That was, I thought, a very good analogy. So we were sitting in front of some beer taps, and I remember you said to me, you know, what is a tap? Do you remember that? Do you remember that story? It'd be good to if you could kind of recount that a little bit to the listeners here, because I think that was a, to me that was kind of okay. Now I understand what you're saying here.
So humans have this ability to generalize. So what I mean by that is that if today, so tap, let's take, you know, we're having a beer and there were these taps. Now taps, different taps look different, right? Tap the sink, the shower, they all look different. But when someone is asked to identify a tap, that person doesn't have to go through, we don't go through all the 750 billion taps that we've seen in our lifetimes, depending on how old you are. Yeah. And then say, that's that tap. Or, I've never seen that before. That's not a tap. I don't know what it is. You don't do that. What we do is we identify certain features of an object, in this case a tap, which we use to identify or classify, in machine learning terms, an object. So that learning happens via machine learning. So machine learning uses data. Data is all the taps we've seen before. And from the data, we recognize patterns. That pattern is what we use now. And those patterns we call parameters. You know, there are parameters that helps us classify. So without getting too deep into technology there or terminology. So we have some features that we know what we need to identify or look out for in order to recognize an object. So for a tap analogy was that, so you saw those taps, they looked really considerably different from the ones you get in the sink, right?
Yeah. In a pub, definitely, yeah.
Yeah. So we could then, but you could still say that's a tap. Even for the first time, when we went to the pub, you know, if you've never been to a pub before, we go and say, that's a tap. Even though the handle looks different, it's going to be pulled as opposed to be twisted. So that's because of the features that you identify or associate with a tap.
Right. Excellent. So let's talk a little bit about data science, because we're going to have listeners with a mixed level of understanding. So what exactly is data science and how does that fit in with the whole AI, machine learning, NLP world? Is it, again, like an all-encompassing terminology?
So AI, consider that to be the area, the subject, the broad subject. So like engineering, right? So engineering. Right. Yeah, I'm sure there'll be engineers who jump down my throat, but as an analogy, engineering is a discipline. AI to me is a discipline, albeit different, but then you've got various parts, various types of engineering. Similarly, you've got different types of implementations of AI. So when it comes to data science is also a subset, but the goal of data science is to manage data sets, the data, and to extract information, analyze the data, extract knowledge, because you have information, right? But that doesn't mean you always have the knowledge.
Right, yeah.
Information represents two different things. So extract the knowledge from that data and also to represent that information in the lowest possible dimensions. What I mean by that is that everything today that we do has a computation cost. So remember that feature, that the tap analogy that we just discussed.
Sure.
We don't remember every aspect of a tap. We remember the key features that define or represent a tap. That allows us to generalize different shapes of taps. So if you memorize just one shape of a tap, which means every feature of it, then we would not be able to generalize, right? Because if something different, we wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. So the idea of a data scientist, or the goal of a data scientist, is to understand the data and the domain, is extremely important, to represent that data in the lowest possible dimensions. That would allow for effective computation downstream. So that is a data scientist. A data scientist will use machine learning to detect patterns, to detect, to identify any outliers, maybe, to identify, to even extract features. You know, could use PCA, could use SVD, could use even machine learning algorithms to extract features. So, but that's data science. So data science, again, is a it's a goal-based unit. You've got to understand what's required. And the specialty in data science is understanding data, visualizing data.
So just to summarize that, essentially, as a data scientist, you're using machine learning to take out the information and perform analysis on it so you can get to the, you know, whatever it is outcome that you're trying to get to. So you are a specialist, or you have been specializing in natural language processing. So can you talk a little bit about that? What is it, NLP, which is the acronym?
Okay. Well, natural language. So, you know, the interesting thing is the more I learn or delve into AI and NLP and speech, I realize how little I know, because this field is so new. It's been around for a while, but the research is still ongoing, and the pace is really, really, it's just mind-boggling at the rate at which models, algorithms changing, and applications changing. So NLP is what? I mean, it's natural language processing, right? Which means I have to talk about natural language first, from an intuition point of view. We've got formal language, we've got natural language. Formal language are very, very rule-based. You deviate from the rule, it doesn't work. It's computer programming language, for instance. Syntax
errors, yeah.
Absolutely. Natural language, on the other hand, has a freer form. You could say the same sentence in different ways and still mean the same thing. You've got a grammar that defines a natural that defines the rules of a natural language, English, Russian, French, German, Chinese, Hindi. But there is a lot of leeway in there. Plus, natural language evolves over time. You know, every year, Oxford adds new words to language. You seldom find that in formal languages. So natural language processing becomes challenging because of the openness and the fluidity in natural language. Hence, that in itself is a field, because that fluidity, that various ways of expressing or representing information lends itself to ambiguity. So one of the key goals that natural language processing aims to achieve is to remove ambiguity. And that is natural language processing, is how to process natural language and come up with the representation that was intended.
But the ambiguity is massive in languages, isn't it, really? I mean, the way that English is probably one of the worst languages for that, really, in many senses.
Yeah.
Okay, so one thing I remember you and I had a discussion a few months back, and you were talking to me about the lack of linguistics experts within NLP. So talk a little bit about that, because what was interesting there was you're saying NLP needs linguists more than necessarily data scientists.
Yeah. So, excuse me. So, again, natural language, right? As you just said, it's openness, it's vastness, it's the rules that govern natural language, the grammar, call it the grammar, that govern natural language. They're different. They're different for different languages. We've got languages that are word order agnostic. There are languages that are not. In English, you know, John or Sanjay spoke to Para. Para spoke to Sanjay. Two different meanings, completely. But the words are the same.
Yeah.
So mathematically or computationally, one can, especially in translation or even text generation, summarization, one can translate word for word, no problem. But in that language, that translated sentence, for instance, wouldn't make any sense, or wouldn't provide the intended semantic or the meaning. So it is like, you know, building a car. I could be a great mechanical engineer and put a car together, but you need somebody who understands cars in order to put together a car that people would like and would work and would sell. So same with natural language, with NLP. If you have an engineer building NLP systems, then computationally, it'll be efficient, it'll be right, it'll work. But it may not have any use, because in the language itself, it will make sense. Therefore, linguistics are equally important to ensure the right grammar, the right structure, the right, even phoneticians are important because, especially in speech processing, in speech recognition, you know, these fields are equally important to come together and work together with the computation side of NLP in order to produce a system or a solution that is acceptable and is viable.
So I think we've set out the core kind of aspects of AI, NLP, data science. And I guess for me, one of the things that always strikes me is it is, as you mentioned, it's constantly evolving, right? It's not set in stone. But obviously there's a huge hype at the moment around implementing AI, and pretty much from an Atom Ventures, Atom CTO perspective, I think the last three or four projects, everyone wants to build in AI to their solution. Now you're someone who's practically implemented machine learning technologies, AI technologies within organizations, right? So if you're going to, if there's a business owner out there thinking, oh, I need ML or I need a, you know, NLP or something like that in my business, what is a starting point? What do you say to them when they start?
So I take the shortcut. I've got a framework. So same with product management, engineering, AI now. I have a framework. And that framework gives me an idea about the project and its needs. So the first thing I ask for is, what's the problem? The problem definition. That tells me, and I think any business should be doing, otherwise be burning dollars needlessly, is this problem or does this problem require an AI solution? First thing, because there has been, or I have been involved in discussions and some projects, I'm guilty of starting some projects years ago, thinking, I'm going to shoehorn AI here. AI is required without looking at the problem definition and understanding the problem.
Yep.
So that's important because sometimes you don't need AI and it could be detrimental, counterproductive having AI in the solution. So not all solutions need AI. Number one, once we've identified and assumed that we need AI, we need the domain. We need to put together a team that comprises domain experts as well as technical experts. It's absolutely important. The importance of domain, I would like to emphasize here, that most AI projects fail at the first hurdle, which is the wrong solution to the wrong problem. But if they get past that, assuming that's all okay, they fail at the domain stage.
Okay, I'll let you continue. I've got a couple of questions, but go on. So I guess my question on the domain aspect is, firstly, what do you mean by domain? But then how deep do you have to be within that domain in order to kind of ensure that you are successful?
Great question. So you don't have to be the oracle in that domain, but you cannot be blind.
So just interrupt. So a domain is essentially a industry or a sector or a problem. Okay, yeah.
That's fintech. So, you know, for instance, there was a time when I was trying to implement a data to text summarizer, and I had all this data with me. I don't know much about it. I don't know anything about investment management. Yeah, and looking at some of the data, and I tried to make sense out of it, and I thought I had. I wrote a summarizer. Now I'm not an expert coder, but I tried something out, and I got a summary which was completely gobbledygook. That's because the features that I picked from the data to look at, tables, the columns, were not the right ones.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so, and I don't have to be a complete expert. I don't have to be an ex-investment map portfolio manager. So that's great if you are, but don't have to be. But the key thing is the appreciation for the need of a domain presence in the team is important. Because that's what I've seen most teams. I've got data scientists. Although the skills are transferable, but there has to be a need for understanding or appreciation of the requirement for the domain knowledge.
So once you've gone through the, is AI suitable, and then you've got the domain knowledge, what's the next part of your framework?
The domain and the tech boys, there, no problem. You've got that. So once you've got that, then the next thing is to understand whether we are building tech or are we using tech. So fintechs typically don't build techs, or healthcare may use tech. So then go out and prototype and quickly understand that first. Because, and sometimes you can build tech as well. It's not a problem. You can build your own models, but you understand what you're trying to do. Because many businesses, I've seen that before, and I've done it before as well, is to go away and try and build a model when there is a model out there already. And now there are pre-trained models, which you can fine-tune even. So you can get them off the shelf, fine-tune them so that's important to understand. Are you going to use or are you going to build? Once you've got there, then you say, right, okay, let's say we're going to build. Or actually, let's take the easy one. Let's say we're going to use, which means you've got the engineers, they plumb together various models, build a pipeline, job done. But the architecture then becomes very important. The architecture has to be coupled or decoupled in a manner that, remember, AI, this field, models are changing, right? They're rapidly, rapidly progressing, right? So we need to be able to swap in and out models. Or once the model is out in the live, it may well be that we decide, oh, hang on, this model is not adequate. We may have to build our own. Imagine trying to unpick your entire architecture to fit in your own model. You don't want that. So you need to be able to have design an architecture that allows us to swap the key components in and out. And finally, the deployment. Now that is where whenever I interview a machine learning or a data science, mainly machine learning engineer, I always ask about their experience in deployment. Because it's all good to build something on a rig or even on a cloud platform. Or a machine learning as a service platform. Great, no problem. But then when you go to deploy the solution, you realize that perhaps the libraries you're using are not deployable. They're mainly made for research. So all that has to be considered at the very beginning, at the start of the project. Say, right, I'm going to deploy it. How am I going to deploy it? How efficient it's going to be? And how often do I have to scale up or scale down? So this is how I would approach machine learning on an AI project.
And I think just stepping back one stage in what you were saying, you could have models, you could have multiple models going through the system, right? So then they're figuring all of that out. So obviously it's a great template, I think, for people who are interested in this. Now, I guess one of the key things that when I talk to people about AI projects or ML projects, what they don't really understand is the volume of data that's actually needed and the cleansing of data and the structuring of data, because they just basically think, I've got all this data, I can throw it at an algorithm and out will come something. So how important is that? I mean, how in the whole process of A identifying, do you have the right data and cleansing it and ensuring it's organized? I mean, how, you know, what do you say to people who are looking to implement? How do you kind of emphasize that to them?
So the second step in the template, that's where, you know, you've got the domain experts. That's where you'd identify the data. So it's required, hence you need the domain experts. Now, data is absolutely the key. That's the key. But there are always situations and problems that we're solving currently in research as well as in out there in the industry where there may not be enough data available. There are techniques like data augmentation, et cetera, that can be used in order to extend or generate more data. But if you're looking for real data coming through, then not always you have raw data. It's very important if you can get the data. Great. So let's assume that there is data. There is data available. You need a data scientist. So you need that domain expert and a data scientist to come and say, right, okay, what bits of that data is important?
How much data do you actually need?
It depends on the problem. It's completely domain related. So the analogy I remember one of our professors used to say, so you want to check, there are certain features of a fish, right? And you want to check. You've got a camera, image processing, you want to classify whether one is a salmon or a sea bass. Now, you've got no data whatsoever to train. You have some data, you've got some data, very little data, and you say, you know what, I'm gonna use that to train my model. Great. So you didn't have much data, you didn't have equal representation of the classes, etc. Got the data. But you deployed that model in Scotland.
Right, okay.
Know very well, yeah, you gotta get sea bass here.
Yeah.
Any fish you gotta get. So that's when the prior becomes important, the prior knowledge of the industry. Hence, you know, that's where the domain thing comes in. So no data or less data is not doom and gloom. That's when your prior becomes important. But as you get more data and your training and your model becomes more and more robust and more, the parameters become more and more tuned and learned, then the importance of the prior, the role of the prior begins to diminish, because now you've got enough data to make an informed guess, to know what is going on. You don't have data, so there are ways. So data is very important, but you don't have data or enough data, it's not doom and gloom, but you need some data. You need data. Otherwise, you just can't produce more than
that. Is it actually worth making it up, though? I mean, because that would that give you false information coming out of it?
Depends. There are data augmentation techniques which are based on mathematics and statistical models that are there that you can start. So you could generate data using neural models where you put in some data and feeds back something else out. You can do that, and that's okay. It's and some places it's recommended too, because you may not, data might change over the course of time and you want to simulate that. So it's not a black and white response to, but what I would caution from is, just because you don't have data, just don't generate data.
Right.
That looks like the data you have, because in a real world, the subset, the sample size that we have available to us, and the sample of, or a larger sample of that population may not look like the sample size we have available to us. So we have a danger there, without doing due diligence and studies of that domain, of creating data which could give us a false representation of the world.
Sure.
So yeah.
So obviously there's a factor of time here, right? So you're building a model, you're processing the data, you're getting results, but when should you really look at implementing the results of that model? Simply because if you don't have enough data and you start implementing it straight away, a year down the line, things are going to differ, right? And change.
So if you're asking about, if this is about, when do I think this is good enough?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Then there, we have to take into account, this is a very pragmatic view of things, We know we don't have enough data. But take that fish example. If you know it's in Scotland, we can have a very high prior for summer.
Sure.
And we can say, right, let's deploy it. We know that any fish we see is likely to be summer. It could be trout, but it's likely to be summer, depending on where we are. It won't be a sea bass.
Yes.
So we can do that. So that's an example where I would say, yeah, you could take a chance. But for mission-critical applications, you've got to be careful. So it's case-by-case basis. Google, Amazon, Facebook, they never release models until unless they're absolutely perfect. There's no such thing at the moment. That's where you've got beta releases. As long as we understand the impact of getting it wrong.
Right.
That's important. Sometimes, especially in speech processing or speech recognition rather, the difference between the cost of a 10% error. So if you've got something which is 70% accurate, you recognize, and something else, and another system that is 80% accurate over the word error rate of 80%, although it's only a 10% difference, but the cost of that error could be double. So again, we have to assess all that. We've got to understand what's the impact of a model that has not been adequately trained.
Right.
So does that answer your question?
It does indeed. This is going to be it's an interesting question. Data scientists are very expensive at the moment, right? They're very highly sought after. So there's pretty much everyone is looking for a data scientist in some respect. Are all data scientists created equal?
Cannot be, because it's like engineers, right? Are all engineers equal?
No.
Or created equal? They're not. So I'm a firm believer that, okay, I'm still not an expert. I don't think anybody is. We're still learning, right? But I'm a firm believer, having gone back to formally study the subject, these subjects, is that data scientists or data science, machine learning, artificial intelligence, vision, speech processing. This is something that requires a formal education. not just because there are resources available online, no problem, but formal education gives you access to researchers, professors, what's going on, you know, there's this there. So I believe that, assume everybody's got formal, even then that doesn't make everybody equal, because data scientists, there are attributes that you look for in data scientists. Number one is their ability to switch domains. Because it's absolutely critical that they understand the domain. That doesn't mean that you can't get a data scientist who doesn't know the domain. It's okay, as long as he's able to quickly switch or adapt to the new domain. Second is their understanding, their foundation in mathematics. It's an applied maths-based discipline subject. They've got to have a theoretical understanding of what's going on and what they need to do. So it's like, you need to understand the tools and where to use them. You don't have to know how the tools are built. You don't have to understand the proofs necessarily, but you need to understand the tools that are at their disposal to be used to solve the problems there. Third is their ability to solve problems. Because we are basically, data scientists are more often than not dealing with huge, vast amount of data, but nearly no knowledge has been extracted from.
Right.
So they should be able to quickly understand what knowledge to be extracted, how to extract that features, how to use the right number of dimensions. Example I always use for features, I can't overemphasize the need for the right features. Like, for instance, if you're classifying two animals, let's say a cow and something, a horse, it's two, pretty much similar size, right?
Yeah.
And I say, right, you know what? It's got four legs. The features that I have now extracted to identify to classify the animals that have been, or images of such animals, they've got a tail, the size, and they've got four legs. Is that enough to classify a cow from a horse? Wouldn't be, right?
No, not at all.
But if I was classifying a human from a cow, probably just the tail is enough.
Yeah.
So that's your data scientist. He'll say, oh, on, this problem does not require four legs. Cow, just a tail. Or four legs, you know. But they would be quickly able to identify those features that are key to representing the information to solve the problem. There may be more features there, but that problem doesn't require them. I don't know if that makes sense.
See, so what you're also saying is experience plays a huge part in all of this, right?
Yeah.
So you know, if you're really looking to do something significant, then hiring someone who's maybe fresh out of university is not necessarily the way forward for you. You're looking at someone with years of experience and being able to spot these issues.
Yeah, I would still not rule out fresh out of university, because they will have access to what's cutting edge and what's not the fresh. So the enthusiasm cannot be, you know, that's brilliant. But because data science is still new, right? I mean, you won't get a data scientist with 10 years experience. I'd be careful, maybe 10 years of domain experience, but data science has picked up over the last few years. So having a fresh graduate is great, but you certainly need that experience along with it to give you.
It's interesting, actually, because, you know, I've come across data scientists who say they've been working on it in 20 years. And I guess there has been, obviously, data science has been around,
of course,
for a very, very long time. So they can make that claim. So how, if you're going to hire someone as a data scientist, I guess a lot of it is, it's like programmers were looked on early on in their career in the history of programming, where, wow, it's magic what you're doing. And data scientists are a little bit like that now, right? Wow, it's magic, you're creating these algorithms. How do you know that the data scientist that you hired is actually good at what they're doing?
So again, those same parameters. So I would be looking for domain expertise, ability to switch between domains, to pick up a new domain, problem solving ability. Absolutely crucial, because you're solving problems. And also the understanding of their role, or the impact their role has within the business. Yeah. So that, now it depends on, if I was interviewing, I have an appreciation and understanding of data science, so I could probably ask some technical questions to understand their level of comfort. But overall, I would say that, you know, The tools are out there, but there's a lot dependent on the mastering of the skill, if you like, understanding of the science behind data science.
Sure. So I guess when you're interviewing someone to find out, you know, their skill sets, you're looking at those key areas that you mentioned around problem solving, ability to kind of context switch between domains. I have to ask you that.
Also projects. I would also ask about projects.
I kind of have to ask you this question because we're talking. You know, there's a great hype about AI taking everyone's jobs, and there's all these crazy statistics that are being thrown out as to how many jobs are being lost. I think 2035, you lose 85% of jobs or whatever. You know, what is your opinion on this?
I think we've discussed this over a pub before. Over a beer before. The example I always use is a washing machine. There was a time when we used to wash our own clothes. Let's say my mom, for a minute, or somebody, or my dad. When the washing machine came over, or was invented and was used, it freed us up for those couple of hours. And it's not just the time, it's also the fatigue after that, because washing clothes is a workout in itself. And that freed us up to do other things. So artificial intelligence cannot take over the world. I disagree, because it's us human. We are still trying to figure out how our brains work, because you're trying to instill that model into a machine, right? If we are not aware, if we haven't figured our brains out, fat chance getting a machine to think like us.
Yes, I was going to say, actually, so there was a conversation I had with a data scientist, and he put it in the sense that if it's something that a human can do in a second or less than a minute, then it's machine learning. You can solve that problem through machine learning or AI. But if it's something that takes you a month to figure out, then you're not going to be able to replace that job.
Also, you know, there are jobs that take time but don't require intelligence to make decisions. To make decisions, which gives us the first cut. So, example, report generation. In fintech, I'm a big believer, a big advocate. Fintechs, you know, investment managers send reports out to their clients, right?
Yeah.
I'm saying, I know that sometimes reports take several days to produce. They've got a team to do that and extract the data. I'm saying, use NLP, data to text summarization, and get the first cut. We still need the client managers.
Yeah.
To look at the report and adjust, but you've just taken away 4 days, which means that if a report took, say, a week, you just saved yourself 2 days. And if you still chose to use the week, you would produce a far better report than you would have, because you would probably have only 2 days or 3 days to adjust once you got the first draft. So you could get the draft at a click of a button, and then you've got 4 days or 5 days to make it even better. So AI to me is an aid.
And I guess in your example there, it'll not only improve reports, but it gives you more time to think about what you've produced, right?
Yeah. And even make it better, because you've just advertising, you know, that's one thing I always say. Yeah. It's not just in fintech or healthcare, advertising. You know, doctors, you know, let's take healthcare for a minute. Healthcare. You know, you could always get the first cut at the diagnosis. But there's a doctor who says, right, okay, you've just saved me a few hours to figure out. You've given me something, and I'm thinking, you know what, that's not right. Or, I know, but maybe, I know which area to look at now. Let me go away and look at. So you could use your time more effectively. That's what I'm saying.
All right, so the last question I have for you today, and it's the one that we always ask everyone. If you could go back in time 20 years and give advice to your younger self, what would that advice be?
Definitely, most definitely, not leave it 21 years to go back to university. I would, if not once every 5 years, I would at least once every 10 years get a formal education. Maybe part-time, no problem. But I would still do that. Because the knowledge aside, the sharpness that those years of those, what, 18 years or 16 years of continuous education that we've had, that gives us, I at least feel that we take it for granted, because we were really sharp. I was really sharp, and I can tell, you know, when I left as a student, when I first graduated, I was really sharp. But over the years, the pressures are different at work. But you don't exactly use some of those skills. You kind of lose them a little bit. But once you go back to uni, the pressure, again, uses a different set of skills than what the pressure at work does. So I think both together, if they are managed, then I would have managed them and continuously keep me going from there.
I guess my only comment on that is that, you know, having seen you work through this second master's, it's not a small undertaking, right? And you are committing yourself. So, I mean, kudos to you to have the energy to do this.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for that, Sanj. It's been great. Pleasure talking to you. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation.
Likewise, mate. Thank you. Thank you for having me over. Appreciate it.
Cheers.
Cheers.